Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, I am Brett King. This is Breaking Banks. Welcome back. On the show this week, we have my co-host, JP Nichols. JP.
Hey, welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so we're gonna be talking about digital health and health technology with a renowned expert in this field, John Noster, shortly. But before we do that, let's get to the conference announcements and to some news. So if you're headed to South by Southwest, don't forget Jason Hendricks, a co-host on Breaking Banks, is speaking at Banking Disrupted, the FinTech Opportunity, on Monday, March 10th from 3:30 to 4:30. Provoke is also the media partner for a VIP fintech reception that's happening down there at South By. It's one of the best fintech parties at South By, so if you can get there, DM Jason Hendricks, at Jason Hendricks, for an invite code if you're into that, if you'd like to catch up with him. On the 5th of March, I'll be at the National Association of Federal Credit Unions. It's at Nashville, Tennessee, USA, on March 5th, where I'll be doing the opening keynote there. So if you can join that, that'd be great. And I'll be heading down to Singapore for Money 2020. Which is going to be, I think that's 11th and 12th of March. And then after that, I'm going to Pakistan, JP, to the Digital Banking and Payments Conference in Karachi. You've been to Pakistan?
I've not.
It'll be good fun. It's been a long time since I've been there. I went to Islamabad years and years ago when I was living in Dubai, but it's been a while. So what have you got coming up, JP?
Well, on the 15th of March, I'm going to be actually here in Seattle over in Redmond on the Microsoft campus, the CU Lytics Summit. It's the largest analytics summit in the credit union space. And I'm actually running about a half-day workshop called Building and Executing on Your Own Innovation Capacity. So participants will get the tools and the frameworks that they need to be able to start their own innovation efforts and can easily scale for more ambitious efforts. So they can register at culytics.com. And also coming up on April 9th through the 11th, the Flourish Branded Currency Conference is in Chicago. I'm going to be keynoting, and Provoke is also a media partner there, so listeners can get a 20% discount when they register with Provoke20, and that's available at flourishcon.com.
Very cool. So let's get to the news. Of course, it's Chinese New Year, just coming off the back of Chinese New Year. Gong hei fa choi.
Xi nian gui le.
Oh, mei wan ti. Ni xian no pu tong wa.
All right. Look, I pushed it as far as I could do by looking up how to say Happy New Year.
But you did it good. The pronunciation was good. So, of course, Chinese New Year, the big news is that we have the red packets. The lucky red packets that people distribute. And of course, over the last few years, really since 2013, 2014, this has been moving all online and digital. And this year, the big news is 768 million people sent red packets on WeChat. That's a 15% increase up from last year. Last year, it was 46 billion red packets, I think. So if it's a 15% increase, what does that work out as, JP?
Well, certainly over 50 billion. And it's a big number.
Yeah. So that's the big news coming out of China this week. Of course, mobile payments wise, I saw figures that 90% of the globe's mobile payments last year were done in China. And 92% of those, of course, went over the two technology networks, which is Tencent WeChat and Alipay. So China is really dominating on the mobile payment scene. But you've got to have these sorts of, you've got to have the network effect. You've got to have these really killer use cases like the red packets that stimulate activity on this. Really interesting to see what's happening there in China. China. Certainly when it comes to the likes of, you know, we celebrate here in Zelle that, you know, they've got an adoption of 20 million people, and you're talking about 768 million people using it in 1 week in China. So we got a way to go in the US before we're anywhere near the sorts of level of adoption that you know, WeChat and mobile payments generally are seeing in China. What else have we got about what else caught your eye in the news, JP?
Well, building on that, Wells Fargo and B of A have both kind of talked about their year-end results, and they both continue to grow their digital footprints. I mean, Wells says they now have 28 million digital customers, B of A at 24.2 million. And one of the drivers that Wells cited was Zelle. Now, they said that their customers moved $10 billion of P2P transactions through Zelle last year, and I think really that was probably, I don't know if that was over the course of the full year or really just the second half of the year as they kind of rebranded in position and started to push Zelle. They're starting some of the advertising around Zelle now. Wells says they're adding 1,000 new Zelle customers per day. We talked about this quite a bit a couple of weeks ago on the show. And as you said, it's very different than a country like China where 95% are engaged in mobile transactions. We've got this whole infrastructure that's been working pretty well for a long time. So there's a bit of a transition as people are moving from one to the other, but it's certainly having impact.
You think checks worked pretty well in the 60s, dude?
When's the last time you've written one?
I can't remember. I may admit to sending a bill payment that where the bank issued a check, but I haven't personally signed a check in, I don't know, 6 years since I've been here in the US. I can't. Well, that's probably not true. I probably have done something for the company, but personally, I don't even have a checkbook.
Well, I'm excited that we're going to talk to John Nosta today about digital health, because I have to admit, I literally had to go to a bank branch today, get an official check and throw it in an overnight envelope because I'm dealing with my father in a nursing home right now. And so I know we're going to talk about really cool things about AI and CRISPR and all that, but I want to make sure we ask John about what about the patient experience and what about the patient's family experience and the billing and all of that kind of stuff. But back to fintech, you know, not unconnected to what we were talking about here. A Wall Street Journal reported a couple weeks ago now, I don't know if you talked about this before, but 1,700 bank branches were shut down in the 12 months that ended June 2017. That's the fastest decline on record, and it's the longest stretch of closure since the Great Depression. Over that five-year period that ended June 17th, Capital One cut 32% of its branches, SunTrust cut 22%, and Regions cut 12%. Those were the top three. Now, Brett, what I want to know is why have you been holding this information back from your listeners? You have been pushing branch.
I know. I mean, everyone knows me as the guy who predicted the death of branches. Although I didn't predict the death of branches, I predicted the consolidation of branches, just like what we're seeing. You know, all the big guys have all done 15 to 20% closures, all the majors. Now we're starting to see the regionals. So if you don't get it right now, this is because people aren't using branches the way they used to. And so if your business is predicated on someone walking to a branch to open a bank account and you have not got an alternative plan, you will be part of the consolidation. I don't know how else to say it, but your business won't be able to survive on branch-led business alone. Now, it doesn't mean every branch in the United States is going to close. I've never said that, but I did predict in Breaking Banks that by 2025 we'd be down to about 50,000 bank branches. You know, right now it would have to speed up for us to get to that, but I do think that certainly by the end of next decade we'll definitely be down at that level, which is half where we were at the peak.
Well, clearly directionally correct. And I had a really busy January. I spoke at five different conferences, mostly around the U.S., one in Hong Kong. And a phrase that kept coming up a lot is it's a quote from Sun Also Rises when they ask a millionaire how he went broke. And he said two ways, gradually, then suddenly. And you know, that's the pattern for disruption.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And we've seen it happen over and over and over again. So why, Why is it that if we're within an industry, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this with health as well, but why is it when you're in an industry as an incumbent, you always think, despite the fact that every time technology disruption has had an industry, it's decimated the traditional distribution models. Why is it that despite all of that evidence, there's still people in banking that have said, yeah, but we're different?
Well, and it's not just banking, to be fair, right? It's any mature industry. And our mature industry has a really long, as Jeffrey Moore likes to call it, the infinitely elastic middle of the business cycle. So we've been in this, you know, slow to, you know, low to single single-digit growth over the last, you know, couple of decades. And it's the classic innovator's dilemma that we don't see all the things that are happening around us. You know, I want to give a hat tip to Brian Rommel, a frequent guest and friend of the show, and he's talked a lot about the rise of voice. And he showed a stat that I actually dug into a little bit deeper, and I've shared with a few of my audiences lately. And it was the gross revenue of BlackBerry. They were doing about $3 billion in annual revenue in 2007 when the iPhone was launched. What do you think happened over the next couple of years after the iPhone was launched?
It plummeted.
Well, I'll jump to the punchline. It increased to $20 billion over the next 4 years, right, from 2007 to 2011. After 2011, though, it's been a steady decline. So there's a delayed result in this, right? So it declined, and now they're back down to 2005 levels, about $1.5 billion a year.
Right. So we had the delay in, you know, with mobile, we had the delay in banking, and now we're starting to see that that decline. And as you said, gradually and then suddenly.
Right. Well, and Green Dot reported a record year too. So, you know, the digital properties, the digital movers, the largest banks in this country and around the world have really been making investments. So they at least have seen, if not making massive shifts, they're at least investing in this. Let's talk a little bit about digital currencies and blockchain.
Did you hear what the governor of the Central Bank of England or the Reserve Bank said about Bitcoin?
Yeah, go ahead. That's exactly what I was going to ask you about.
He said it had failed as a currency, as a cryptocurrency. But that's a view of, if you take a black and white view of Bitcoin was meant to replace all global currencies or all fiat currencies or become the poster child for a digital currency, then you could say Bitcoin has failed. But I think, you know, I mean, obviously Bitcoin has morphed into a digital asset class right now. But if you look at Bitcoin in terms of its volatility, if we can get that under control, then certainly Venezuela, Zimbabwe, other regions right now that have problems with fiat currencies, you could see them potentially adopting a digital currency as a challenger to theirs.
Well, I'll go back to a phrase I just said a few minutes ago about your prediction of decline of branches. It's directionally correct, right? We're going to more digital currencies, and I'll steal a line I heard from one of the regulators when I was in Hong Kong a few weeks ago. The crypto part is super interesting. It's the currency part that we have to really figure out. And, you know, as we've talked about numerous times, the underlying blockchain distributed ledger technology, super, super interesting. It's when you try to think about having a currency, and one of the things that's implied when you say currency is, you know, some sort of stability and some recognition of that for multiple players. But I saw that same article and I thought it was interesting. So, you know, it was the Treasury Select Committee, which is really going to look down at the FCA and the Bank of England and the government, the whole governance process in the UK, to really look at the oversight of cryptocurrencies in the UK.
Absolutely. Well, let's get on to health tech, shall we?
Great.
Our guest today is John Noster. He's, apart from being a friend of mine, he's also a founder of Noster Lab. That's a digital health think tank. In 2012, he also started Health Critical, a blog on Forbes that discusses the link between health, medicine, and technology. He's twice been listed at the top of the Pharma 100 list, and that measures the level of online engagement produced by those in the health tech or health industry. And he's on the faculty of Singularity University. He's on the Google Health Tech Healthcare Advisory Board, amongst a bunch of other stuff. He's advised the U.S. government on numerous occasions. John Noster, welcome to the show, Breaking Banks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Brett, last time we were together was in Moscow.
It was. Yeah, we were at the, what was it? It's the innovation...
Skolkvo.
Right, right. So, yeah, and we that was pretty cool, where we did the conference in, where is it? They had the Winter Olympics, Sochi, right?
Sochi, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, and they had the Buran spacecraft at the front, and yeah, it was pretty cool. So it was in Moscow. So yeah, it's been a few months. When was that? Was it November?
I think it was November. Yeah, it's interesting. You're seeing the push to embrace technology as a functional and practical way of leapfrogging some of the issues in Moscow and really in the world. So that was kind of an interesting observation, is that technology is not a natural extension, step one, step two, step three, step four, but it seems to be a fix to an existing problem. For example, we talked a lot about telemedicine there, and in the rural environment of Moscow, the ability for a person to speak with or see or connect with a cardiologist is quite different, quite difficult. So, yeah. So that was kind of interesting. But you started off, today talking about some of the fintech stuff, and I'm scratching my head. I'm saying, wow, there are a lot of interesting comparisons. First and foremost, I guess people say that health is wealth. So that's my fundamental comparison. So we can start there.
Okay.
And what interests me is that there's this shift, this fragmentation, the decrease in the number of branches that you were talking about, and to me, I see something similar to that in the sense of a consolidation and movement of Amazon into this space.
Now, I was going to definitely ask you about Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon, JP Morgan, that alliance they've announced.
But, there's a flip side to that, because the hospital as sort of the quintessential sort of base of operation for care and procedures is now being fragmented. We're actually pushing people out of the hospital earlier. We're trying to get people out of the hospital completely for procedures. We're seeing the emergence of branches, health branches on the corner, things like CVS.
Right, urgent care facilities and so forth.
Yeah, so I think that in a way there's kind of a change there to what really drives a lower cost model. So that may be the thing that ultimately is driving that. But for me, what I'm seeing is this shift from control to collaboration, this sort of old school mentality of I'll write the check, I'll put it in the mail and I'll send it to you, or the same way, I'll go to the physician and he, and I use that word very specifically, will not write the check, but write the prescription and give it to you, and then you go to your pharmacy, and it's this whole process that is dominated by the one-way arrow, the control. And what I'm seeing generally is that shift to more of a collaborative engagement across stakeholders. And I can see that with patients who are more involved in their care. They want to know what their numbers are. They know that they can provide better, let's say, control of their blood sugar as a diabetic. We're seeing large pharmaceutical companies look at a collaborative model to find the lightning bolt of innovation to help integrate into their research and development model. So a lot of really, really interesting things going on from a logistical, functional, practical perspective. It doesn't even speak to the wow of some of the technological advances.
So, let's dive straight into the tech a little bit.
Sure.
Because I know... I'd like to talk about structurally. We can come back to that and how things are impacting the industry from a structural perspective. But what are the major leaps in terms of technology that you're seeing happening at the moment that will have the biggest long-term impact in the way we think about healthcare and the way healthcare, pharmaceuticals, healthcare providers, the way their role will shift in our day-to-day well-being?
Well, to me, I think that the ultimate leveraging of big data is going to be the game changer. And, you know, we talk about machine learning and AI, and while there's a lot of reluctance there, and I think there is an overstatement, I'm a big fan, and I think that's going to be a fundamental game changer in clinical medicine, where it's no longer AI, but also IA, in terms of intelligence augmented. I think we will see a shift where physicians, patients, nurses, other medical professionals, caregivers, will have their intelligence augmented through the use of big data. I've always been a fan of big data as the third fundamental window into humanity, where we have the microscope and the telescope as these colossal inventions that changed our worldview. And I think big data will do that. Now, big data analytics will also be combined with things like genomic analysis. That in of itself is a major step forward from a technological perspective, but our ability to process that information and to analyze that information is extraordinarily difficult. So those two things coming together, I think, represent an extraordinary advance both in diagnosis, patient management, and aspects of care.
So I'm really interested in the genomic piece of this. Of course, you know, Singularity faculty often talks about this, the fact that we've had exponential computing power that has really assisted us, particularly on the genome side of things. Kurzweil talks about the fact that, you know, it cost, you know, $10 billion in 13 years to sequence the first human genome, and now, you know, we can effectively do a quick pass for 6,000 base pairs for $99 now with the likes of 23andMe. But you could sequence your entire genome today for under $1,000, right?
About $800. But here's the interesting thing about that. Number one is it's getting cheaper and cheaper. It's sort of the opposite of or analogy to Moore's law. That it's getting extraordinarily less expensive. But this is the other side of that coin. It's fast. So now,
right, it's
not
much,
like,
much faster, yeah.
Right. So I can get admitted to the hospital and I can have pretty much a full genomic sequence done overnight. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. So it's really it's cost and speed. If it's cheap, it takes too long, it's not functional clinically. And I'm of the belief that it's probably going to go down to zero. This is a Google Map, Waze, right, dynamic. You know, give us
and same with stuff like blood work and so forth. Even though Theranos is got a bad rap, the trajectory is moving towards essentially a machine where you can put in a, you know, you can give it a drop of blood or you know, you can give it a piece of DNA or whatever, and that analysis will be done almost instantaneously within not too distant future, right?
Oh, there's a company called NanoBiosys. Anita Goel is the CEO, brilliant Harvard MD, PhD, that has existing technology in place and approved by the FDA today. And one of the modalities is to measure Zika, to determine in the field with a drop of blood using a DNA, a genetic-based test, to look for Zika virus. So, you know, it's here. We're seeing things like that all over the place. It's sad about Theranos and the black eye that they gave the market. I think it's sort of a double-edged sword. It was a kick in the pants. It got people real about clinical development and the difficulties around it. But I also think there are many, many avenues that are coming down. You know.
Yeah, you never know. They might come back. They're still around, so we'll see.
You know, they got like a bunch of money. I don't know what it was. And people were writing me, how come they got, you know, $20 or $30 million? And it actually was just debt refinance, debt restructuring.
Right, right. So now the other aspect of this, of course, is we're developing not only the technology to sequence DNA and be able to diagnose based on that, but of course we're learning how to edit DNA. Can you explain the technologies that are sort of, you know, that are emerging around this?
Well, let's start off with the fundamental premise. Everyone worries about pre-existing conditions and the ability to get insurance and how that could potentially be an obstacle if there were not laws in place. I would argue that we're all born with pre-existing conditions. And they are, you know, deep down in our DNA, and they ultimately manifest sometimes in childhood and sometimes in adulthood. So the code, the base code for our bodies is our DNA. And what we've found of recent is that there are methods, technologies. The one that you're referring to is, of course, called CRISPR. And CRISPR is a gene editing technology using a viral vector that goes in and snips the DNA and changes that particular code. So, you know, when you're talking about genetic abnormalities, let's say such as conditions called thalassemia or other small code problems, you can go in and you can actually fix it. Now that's the good news. The bad news is that recent studies have shown that there may be an intrinsic mechanism that protects against that. So it's a wonderful and profound tool, both for laboratory and potentially clinical work. But as we get smarter and as we take a closer look at the real, not in vitro, but in vivo dynamics of this process, there are some red flags. So I think that CRISPR is a fundamental game changer. That's good.
So CRISPR-Cas9 tech is essentially, we developed this by watching the way viruses and bacteria interact with each other, right?
Bacteria was principally the way it was found, yes, and then it was used in, you know, in animals. So I think that's going to be, it's, you know, remember the early days of shotgun DNA recombination, all that crazy stuff? I think that people are a little frightened of this because this is really going right to the source code and making changes. But I think that that's probably one of the top five or maybe six or seven technological innovations that's going to change potentially drug development and the way we treat diseases. You know, right now, the interesting thing is we treat diseases after we have an overt manifestation. Think of something like breast cancer, where a woman feels a lump. I mean, how barbaric is that? Feels a lump? Stage 4, stage 3, stage 4.
And we know genetically now the markers for that. We should be able to work it out.
Completely. So, you know, you can address this. And what a lot of people, you know, Dan Kraft at Singularity, a lot of people are calling this stage 0 disease. That really, that's the point at which we could detect and manage disease, whether it be on a genetic level or just an early mutation level, or even the emergence of an early cancer form, or even an early heart attack. We're looking at technology now. Some of it is nanoparticles, some of it is genomic testing, to find the earliest subclinical sign of a disease and then really kill it in its infancy. And I think that's a really, really interesting way of kind of looking at disease. It's a game changer, and it's one of probably two or three core changes around we're going to be looking at disease management in the future.
Well, before we go to break, you may not be able to answer the whole thing before break, but what ethical concerns do we have to figure out as a society before we can do some of these things?
You know, when I do my presentations around the world, my first slide is a robot, the hand of a robot shaking the hand of a human. And I qualify my answers as being a techno-optimist. So I'm going to hedge that answer a little bit. But I think that we need to recognize that the advances in ethics follow a parallel track. We often look at advances in almost any innovation, and we gauge it against today's rules and regulations. So we go out 10 years with AI, and then we measure AI's utility against today's standards. So I think there's a good deal of work moving forward on the ethical considerations. Absolutely, it's something that is both newsworthy, you know, a la Elon Musk and the evil overlords. But, you know, as I dig deep on this and I look at, you know, organizations like DARPA and even Google, these are areas of deep and important research. It just doesn't really get the kind of play that people would give to other sort of, you know, the evil overlord dynamics.
No, I get it. All right, well, listen, John, let's just take a quick break, and then when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the players in health tech that you find interesting. Maybe we can ask you about, blockchain application. I know you're not an expert in that, but we could get your opinion on that, and generally talk about, some of the milestones that we're going to see over the next decade or two in respect to changes in healthcare. All right?
Perfect.
Okay, so you guys, you're listening to Breaking Banks, JP Nichols and Brett King hosting the show today with our guest John Noster. We'll be right back after these short messages from our sponsor.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. I'm here, of course, with JP Nichols, my co-host on the show. Did you see the news about the former manager of the Department of Defense? Did you see that news that came out a while back?
No, but what about it?
He said UFOs are real.
Oh, I did see that.
Yeah, did you see that? That's interesting. So maybe that's where we're going to get the next generation of health tech.
Well, that might be where our next gene editing technology comes
from. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, splicing some alien DNA or I don't know. Did you ever watch the Battlestar Galactica, the reboot of Battlestar Galactica?
A little bit, but I have to tell you, I'm going to lose my geek card if I start talking about how little I watch some of the sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
You want to talk about James Bond, Jason Bourne? I'm there with you. I'm only going to be vaguely familiar. Although I will say, I was excited to see back from my childhood the reboot that's coming on Netflix is Lost in Space. So I'll definitely be watching.
Oh, I didn't realize that they're bringing that back.
Yep.
Will. Wow, because they
danger
did that.
Will Robinson.
Danger, Will Robinson. Yeah, okay. No, because they did have that movie with the, you know, was Joey from Friends. What's his name, that actor?
Yeah, Matt LeBlanc.
Yeah, Matt LeBlanc. He does Top Gear as well. So they did a remake of Lost in Space years ago with that, right? But I don't think it was huge.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a Netflix reboot. I think it's a series. I just saw the banner ad last night.
All right, so, but, you know, if UFOs were real, it would explain a lot that's going on right now on the planet. But anyway, John, back to health tech. There's a bunch of, you talked about health is wealth. There is a bunch of technologies, of course, right now that are looking at elements of healthcare, such as like quantified self we have now. People are able to monitor their own blood sugar using wearables now and things like this. There's a lot of parallels there with the way, financial services are moving too, with, Movin, Digit, Acorns, embedded financial health built into the day-to-day financial services experience. So my question to you, I guess, is, how do you see, you talked a little bit about it, but, where do you see the frontier being in respect to your individual care based on data And how much do things like sensors and apps and things like that, determine the successfulness of those things?
That's a great question. You know, let's talk about closed loop financial services. So it all comes together in this vast ability to monitor spending, to save money, to really have this closed loop system. And we're seeing that in healthcare. Probably diabetes is one of the greatest examples, where we're seeing the convergence of dermal sensors combined with small infusion pumps. And what we're doing is we're actually infusing insulin as needed based upon the real-time measurement of blood glucose. So that's an extraordinarily important therapy. You know, the trick to that is most drugs you have to take once a day or twice a day or however. Insulin you take as you need. So the ability to modulate insulin is intrinsic in the therapy. So that's an advantage. That's why you're seeing the advantages there.
And are we getting close to, how far away do you think it will be from someone being able to either have an implant or a wearable that not only will monitor their blood sugar but regulate their insulin?
Well, you know, to a certain degree, we're seeing tremendous work at some of the big companies like Medtronic. You know, you always look for the early Googles, the garage companies. But Medtronic, you know, is a big device manufacturing company, has been very successful at looking at what they're calling the artificial pancreas. So we're seeing the emergence of that language. We're seeing the closed loop system available now. It's a little clunky. You know, there's still a small insulin pump that you wear. There's a small a glucose detector that you put on either your arm or your abdomen. But the components are there. And the rest is not that hard. So I think we are functionally 3 to 5 years away from seeing self-contained, probably totally implantable technology that can manage diabetes. So, you know, we're there now, and we're moving there very, very quickly.
Very so, cool. John, let me ask, how is the growth of kind of sports tech driving this? And I ask, sitting here in Seattle, it's a good day because the Seattle Sounders starts their soccer season today in Champions League, and Jordan Morris, our striker, is type 1 diabetes, and he's been very vocal about using technology to be able to manage health and to compete at a very elite level with type 1 diabetes. And also there's an intersection with all of these monitors that athletes are wearing and all that. Are they feeding each other?
Well, JP, you just hit the nail on the head. You said athletes, right? I mean, let's face it. Most people don't use their fitness trackers. The proverbial 10,000 steps or the quantification of your athletic endeavor is a tool to woo a mate. You wear it at the gym. It's your badge of honor. It's not a clinical tool, and that's simply because it is an athletic option versus a clinical imperative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at the 65-year-old obese man with high blood pressure and metabolic syndrome, and you give him an activity track, and you tell him to walk. It's not going to work. So there is a real issue. You know, we're seeing some innovation around the monitoring of blood lactate, and recovery times and altitude training to help drive some of the innovation. But I still struggle with the practical aspects of using active data acquisition. Now, then you go to passive data acquisition. If we can put sensors in our bed and sensors in our chairs and sensors in our toothbrushes and sensors in our mirrors in our bathroom and in our toilets, we now see the emergence of companies like Kohler and big box stores play a role in embedding sensors in carpets too. And getting passive data acquisition. That may be more powerful. So I don't see the athletic area and athletes really driving anything but some, you know, esoteric elements. Now that may go against the trend. The other point that I find real interesting is that for me, the innovation will not be the nudge psychology around a little thing on my arm telling me to take my pill or, you know, a device that buzzes me and makes me get up and move around. Those are fairly mundane and not very sophisticated. I think the advances that are really going to change our lives is a little bit more akin to the way we manage our car. When our tire wears out, we replace it.
And so what are you... So I'm very interested in the Proteus, the ingestible device they have, where you can swallow this tablet. It's got a chip inside it, powered by your stomach acid, sends a signal to a Band-Aid patch you wear on your stomach, and then that transfers to your mobile phone. Just mind-blowing sorts of technology. But those technologies as a class, how soon do you think that it'll be ubiquitous and available to a broad section of the population?
Well, again, the technology around Proteus lies around detection and compliance versus an absolute therapeutic modality that really drives efficacy or a superior outcome. So, they're going to happen very quickly. I think the technology is there. I don't know if we have the desire to incorporate them. I think that the impetus is to go in other directions around advanced therapeutics. And the point I was making about the car is that when we have a problem with our car...
I was going to ask you to come back to that, actually, so I'm glad you did that on your own.
Because there's a check engine light for your car. Okay, we have no idea what it means. And quite frankly, we really don't even care what it means. But it's one of 160 sensors that tell us something is wrong. You plug it in and you fix it. And usually it's tantamount to adjusting something or replacing something. And I think that's the nature of healthcare in the future. We will replace an organ. We will use stem cell therapy, which is a really, really fascinating, although problematic area, where we can infuse people with these pluripotent stem cells that can actually grow into whatever we need, collagen, bone, hair, heart, muscle, whatever it might be. So to me, that's the new perspective on care. We'll go to the doctor and they'll plug us in.
Yeah,
check engine light will go off on our smartwatch and say, make a visit to the doctor. So I think that there are fundamental changes that will impact care. And we're seeing that right now. There's different kinds of therapy that look at restorative medicine versus chronic care to nurse a sick organ, ultimately to our demise. It's a real kind of fundamental shift.
Well, and I was just going to say, I think waiting until the check engine light comes on is the way too many of us manage the health of our car, and that's not the right way. So I like this idea of things that are more proactive.
Well, I guess it depends on the sensitivity of the check engine light, because at some point, if we can get the determinant to be as close to stage zero as we talked about earlier, if I can have a check engine light that finds the first cancer cell in my body,
that's huge.
And there's the shift. Here's the shift.
Sorry, okay. JP.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's different than a check engine light. If you have a high performance car, if you were racing your car, you have a whole set of gauges, and that's being monitored, outside of the car from your team. And I think that's what we're heading towards, and what I think is a lot more interesting than just a dumb red light that's either on or off.
Maybe. Well, what about the Alive Core tech that they've integrated with the Apple Watch recently? Where does that sort of stuff fit in?
I think Alive Core is really the prototypical example of success in the digital health space. So basically, a cardiologist.
For those that aren't familiar with that technology, we've got a lot of listeners on the AM band here in New York, so New Jersey. Can you explain the basics of how that technology works?
I've got one in my hand right now.
Very cool.
Basically, it's a small metal disc that you hold with two hands, your thumb on either side on the top and your first two fingers on the bottom. And it connects wirelessly to an app in your smartphone. You download the app and it takes a single lead EKG. So in other words, it looks at your heart rhythm and it measures it for about 20 or 30 seconds and it stores it as a PDF file, and you can send that file off to your cardiologist, or you can send it off for it to be read, or it can read it live in the cloud. So if you have a symptom, if you have palpitations, if you're short of breath, if you have a prior condition where your physician said, we have to monitor this, if you feel bad, or if you feel dizzy, or if you feel a fluttering in your chest, take out your Alive Core and take a look at the EKG and send me a sample. So think of it in terms of functionality, of cost, of convenience. And one of the interesting things that we're finding with Alive Core is that it's determining, it's finding this arrhythmia, this beating abnormality that's called atrial fibrillation. And basically, atrial fibrillation is very common, particularly in older people, where the heart doesn't beat regularly. It's irregularly irregular. Boom, 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 boom. It's not that normal boom, boom, boom rhythm. And this is associated with abnormal blood flow in the heart, resulting in clots and stroke. And strokes associated with atrial fibrillation are catastrophic, very, very high incidence of death. And of course, the debilitating consequences of if you don't die, you very well may be paralyzed. So the detection of asymptomatic atrial fibrillation using a $99 device that you get on Amazon is an extraordinary advance in sort of the aspects of digital health. We look past
And when you apply that data to something like an artificial intelligence that has a large sample size of the population, then we might be able to even predict when you're going to have a heart attack.
Sure, sure. You can. There's all sorts of injury predictions. You know, there's epidemiologic considerations. You can get large populations. There are, you know, individual issues for a person that, you know, they're even saying now that Google is looking at the back of your eye using a traditional retinal type scan that could predict based upon the architecture of the blood vessels in the back of your eye whether or not you're going to have a heart attack.
That's crazy.
So, you know, combine that with a live core. You know, it's really amazing. But it was, again, it's a garage company started by a cardiologist named Dave Albert. And, you know, the CEO now is out of COSLA. So it's really brings a lot of interesting people together to create a tool that there's a couple things. One, it's functional. In other words, it fits a need. Number two, it's easy to use. It's patient friendly. And number three, it's been clinically validated. They spent a lot of money on doing clinical trials. And to me, the disconnect between a good idea that fits into the clinical hierarchy and fills a need is often a problem. People make digital health tchotchkes because it's cool, or they put together things that don't often have a real clinical utility. That's a bit of a problem.
So I do want to come back to one thing you talked about earlier, which you talked about replacing organs. So talk to us about 3D printing technology, bioprinting, and where we're at in respect to the development of those technologies, because that sort of means the end of the whole transplant list thing, right?
Well, you know, here's the thought around that. We're no longer organ donors, we're data donors. So I think that our ability to grow organs either in a cellular matrix, so in other words, we take a matrix, an artificial matrix, and we grow cells on them and we create a new organ, or we actually use a 3D printing methodology, an additive technology, to build templates of organs that have vasculature grow right into it, is here. The work is being done now. 5-6 years ago, they did it in the lab, built a rat's kidney. And so that technology is here. United Therapeutics is a company that's working on the development of lungs, artificial lungs and artificial organs. So that's a very, very exciting area. And again, not only does it change the transplant dynamic, you know, Brett, it changes the clinical care dynamic, that if we can grow organs at will, and I know that's a stretch onto a stretch, but we go in and after 30,000 miles, we replace it, or 50,000.
Yeah, why would you wait for it to develop a problem?
Let's just put in a new. Now, the other side of that is this whole notion of regenerative therapy. And
so talk about that. What is? I mean, it sounds obvious, but just explain regenerative therapy in terms of where we're at with that.
In the simplest of terms, we are all derived from one primordial cell. That cell is called a stem cell, a pluripotent stem cell, and stem cells are what differentiate into every single cell in our body. So they become hair or collagen or bone or muscle or whatever. And what we find is if you operate on a child in vitro, the child has no scar. The tissue, because it's so rich with pluripotent stem cells, it's so vibrant building this thing in a bioreactor that we call a baby, there is no scar. And oftentimes we see this in children. You know, why do children's skin looks so firm and so tight? It's because of their collagen. And the collagen over time is no longer repaired because the number of stem cells pretty much fall off linearly as we get older. So stem cells are our body's repair kit. And if we could acquire stem cells and administer them in some appropriate way, we can have our body take care of itself by fixing problems that occur. You know, I mean, you know, Peter Thiel and his interest in getting transfusions.
Youth transfusions.
What's that about? That's about stem cells. And, you know, there's a company called Cellularity. They just got about $250 million. They were in the press last week. Peter Diamandis is on the board, co-chairman.
Fellow Singularity faculty, of course.
They come out of Singularity, and they're doing a lot of work. Bob has studied the stem cell and very interesting bioactive cells that are derived, and I'm going to go back real quick. We talked about no longer being organ donors or being data donors. There is one organ that we really need to take care of and use, but we end up throwing it away, and that's the placenta. So what Cellularity is doing is actually using placental-based cells to capture stem cells or other bioactive cells that can be used in developing therapeutics. Now, these cells are very powerful, they're very effective, but they also have an immunological cloaking mechanism, which means they don't react like other foreign substances would. And let me jump to that other therapy we talked about, and that's the whole notion of immunotherapy.
Yep.
So immunotherapy is one of the biggest advances in medicine today. It takes a cell in your body, takes it out, an immune cell, puts it into a bioreactor and cooks it and programs it to go after your own cancer. So isn't that just amazing? Your body fights its own disease. Now that's real interesting. That's immunotherapy. That's really the breakthrough. Some of the language around it is the CAR-T platform, C-A-R-T platform. And there are three fundamental issues around that. Number one, it's extraordinarily expensive. The price for that therapy now is about $450,000 for a course of therapy. Absolutely staggering. Makes the Hep C therapies, the hepatitis therapies, seem cheap.
So John, this is a unbelievably fascinating discussion. You've been a great guest. So before we have to close, and this mm-hmm. has gone all too quickly, maybe we'll just loop it back. You said a few minutes ago some of the parallels that you saw between fintech and health tech, and clearly one of the things is data. Can you maybe give us just some closing thoughts on that before we have to wrap up today?
Well, you know,
how's the management of patient data going to occur when you need this collaboration you talk about?
In 2 weeks, there's the health informatics meeting, HIMSS, in Las Vegas. It's one of the most important meetings in the health tech space, because it's really based upon informatics about data. And I believe that unlocking human exhaust, unlocking all the data that we naturally just push out into that human ecosystem will really give physicians, researchers, and ourselves the opportunity to understand humanity in a way that's going to shift evolution in new directions.
Great. Well, that's very cool. So, what are you spending most of your time on these days, John? Apart from talking around the world on health tech,
hanging out with you in Russian hotels, Brett. Right?
Now, that was just the once.
That was just the.
I'm not associated with any Russian bots. So I'll just put
all
that
right.
There.
That's
those rumors are untrue.
So one of the things for me is actually sort of codifying and quantifying technological innovation and translating it. That's number one. However, for me, what I find that's most fascinating in this techie world, and this techie world is inhabited by traditional scientists, by the garage scientist, by the patient, by the parent. But what they're doing is they're all winking in the dark. They're not diffusing the innovation into the mainstream. So what we're finding is that people don't understand the nature of the innovation. So what I've been trying to do is help companies and big ones, as well as small, diffuse innovation to create marketing plans, strategic plans that help them understand how to absorb this stuff.
I get it. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Your Twitter ID is at at John Noster, of course.
Yes, sir.
And where else can people keep in touch with you?
Twitter is probably a great way, johnnoster.com and nostalab.com.
Nostalab.com. Right. Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us on the show today. It's been delightful as always and very informative, and we really appreciate it. That's it for the show today. JP, thanks for co-hosting with me.
Always a pleasure.
Yep, and I guess we'll run into each other soon somewhere. But for those of you listening out there, don't forget to check out provoke.fm, breakingbanks.com. Check out our back catalog of over 200 episodes there. Please, if you're using iTunes, Google Play, leave us a review, leave us some comments. Reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, wherever, whichever social media platform you use. Let us know what content you'd like to see on the show over the coming weeks and months, and we'll get on that. But thanks again for joining us. We'll be back with another show next week, next Thursday. We'll be listening to an interview with the guys at Bink, talking about their technology in the loyalty space. But that's it for the show this week. See you guys next Thursday.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.